We've arrived at the last night of our retreat. Seems like one's been here forever. I hope that we've been able to offer something like a toolbox that now we can take with us as we enter back into our daily life, which in some ways is where the real work begins. How to apply what we've learnt in this laboratory of the meditation retreat, where we have a chance to look at the subtler processes of the mind and body and heart, and to pick up some of these tools. Beginning, if you remember, we started with the cultivation of the calming meditation, foundation of mindfulness, of learning to take our attention from the concerns and the worries and the disappointments of the world, which can overwhelm us and get us tangled up. This skill of training attention to what is here, and very simply being with the body and breath over and over again as a practice, as the Buddha encouraged, to be with the body and the breath, and then the feelings and the moods of the mind, but not being with them by being lost in them or resistant, but by being mindful of them, mindfully illuminating our experience with this attentiveness. And being able to also investigate and look more deeply into our experience. So this gatheredness and mindfulness and investigation, these tools that we can use, as Ajahn Chah said, is not just in a meditation retreat, but if we breathe, if we have time to breathe, we have time to practice. Another way that the Buddha talked about this practice, from one shore to another, from a place of distress or suffering or limitation, and crossing over that stream of the mind that's connected with suffering, through using and applying these tools to recognize moments of, not in a big flashing light enlightenment, but moments of really being able to recognize the peaceful, even in the midst of the movement. When there's a letting go or non-identification with the movement, moments of recognizing the background, the awareness of the heart. This process that the Buddha said, it's like this movement from one shore to another, from suffering to non-suffering. He said it's like taking a raft, using a raft. His teachings that he communicated, he made the analogy being like a raft. A raft is a bit like a boat that takes you over that sea, takes you across. And that to make that raft, you don't have to make a big, perfect ship or liner. You could just get together. He talked about just getting the twigs and the branches that are around you on the shore where you are. So not to wait till we have the most perfect conditions, the most perfect teacher, the most perfect retreat, because usually that doesn't actually happen in real life. This is it. This is what it's like. Yeah, sort of slightly wobbly and imperfect. So it's perfect because it is what it is. So taking from what's around us, and using that, using everything we can to support our journey, and to not wait and hang out and try and get to that special place where it will be, we'll hear the exact right answer or meet the master, whatever it is. I spend a long time really wanting to meet the right master, not realizing that actually while I was looking for the right master, the life was teaching me all the time. And I remember one of the journeys that I took to India, which of course is the place you go to look for masters, and of course India itself is the workout that you realize in the end is going to take you to your limits and beyond. It's the teacher. And I went to an ashram. I was a great disciple, still am, of a great realized being called Neem Karoli Baba, who lived in the hills of the foothills of the Himalayas, and was had a great impact on many people's journeys. And so I went to one of his ashrams up in the Himalayan foothills of Nainital and Kanchi. And he, by that time, he had reached what we call Mahasamadhi, means he kind of dropped his body. And so I wasn't able to see him physically. So I was hanging around in the ashram in a certain way, still kind of looking for the master. And it was great, it was good, but there was a little bit of disappointment somehow. It was a little unconscious, because of course, rationally, he wasn't around anymore, physically. And I was a nun at the time, and I had my attendant with me, and we went to the bus station to move on to the next place of our pilgrimage. And at the bus station, you know, it's one of those chaotic scenes in India. You don't know what bus to get on, and sort of running around trying to find the right bus. And then we had to get to our next place before midday. Otherwise, I turned into a pumpkin, which meant I couldn't eat anymore after midday. And so there was all this stress about getting my meal. And of course, we finally found the bus to where we were going. And of course, it didn't move because it's India, and I was getting really uptight and looking at my watch, or I didn't really have a watch, or looking or whatever, my clock. And then out the window, I was looking out the window, and I saw like this crazy guy that was just sort of reeling around the bus station. He had his dhoti and kurta, and he had sort of betel nut all down him, that red sort of like stuff that they chew, and he looked like mad. And I looked and I thought, wow, I really hope that guy doesn't get on this bus. And it's almost as soon as I thought that, he just made a beeline for the bus. And he got on the bus, and he just looked at me, and he came right up to me, and he said in this perfect English, he said, "Madam, this isn't England. Buses are not going on time." And the whole bus, and I, you know, the worst thing for an English person is to be the center of attention. Now, I know Americans like it, and maybe Israelis do too, but if you're an English person, it's excruciating. You kind of want to disappear. So I was like, you know, it was a terrible moment for me, because the whole bus started looking at me, and he started making fun of me, and, "Madam, you must be more patient," and here I am as a Buddhist nun with a shaved head, and supposed to be spiritual, and everyone's cracking up, and I'm sort of hoping he will go. And then he turns to me, and he fixed me with this really penetrating gaze. And he said, "Madam, where are you going?" And it was like one of these sort of like archetypal questions. And I just went, well, I didn't really get it at that level at that moment, because I was going, well, we're going to Nainital, and we're going here, and we're going there, and we're going down to Bodh Gaya. And he listened to all this, and then he looked at me, and he said, "Well, if you think you know where you're going, you don't know anything at all." And then he really looked at me, and I thought, my God, who is this guy? And then he got off the bus, and I looked at my attendant, and we looked at each other, and I looked out the window, and I thought, the master. and he disappeared. He completely disappeared, because I was about to sort of go and, like, you know, try and have another go. So you never know. You never know what guise the teaching will come in. Which is very similar to also when I first met Ajahn Chah, one of the first times I met Ajahn Chah in England. And actually he came, the very first time I met him was when I was doing one of these Goenka workout retreats, you know, which was really intense, as many of you know. And I was sitting there in a hall, about 70 of us young people, trying to, I didn't even know what I was trying to do, because the teacher couldn't actually speak English. He was a Burmese monk, and I had no idea the whole time what I was supposed to be doing. I think I understood the word observe, but I didn't quite know what to observe. And actually halfway through the retreat, it was so intense that I decided I'd make an escape plan. So I made this huge plan. I thought, well, I'll go when they're all having tea. And I packed my little suitcase, and about 5 days in, I felt like I'd been there like five eons. It went so slowly, and I was in such pain. So I packed my case, and I didn't tell anyone, and actually I was there with my boyfriend. I didn't even tell him. I don't even know why I didn't tell. I just got to get out of here. So I packed my case, and I was sort of walking. It was one of these old, old Victorian houses in Britain that was been bought by this Burmese couple who turned it into a center. And I timed it very badly, because as I was walking down this sweeping driveway, I turned around, and in the bay windows were 70 yogis having their tea, looking at me with my suitcase. And, you know, again, for a Brit, it's very excruciating to have that much attention, especially when I was trying to escape quietly. So I quickly sort of pretended nothing was happening and jumped over the fence into this field of brambles and stinging nettles, and started to sort of wade through this whole kind of forest of things that stung, and finally got down to the road, and then realized I didn't actually have any money, because I'd come with friends and gotten a lift, and I didn't have any money in those days. And so I thought, well, I'll hitch a lift. And then I started hitching a lift, and of course no one stopped. So then it started to get dusk, and I'd been standing there, and then I thought, oh well. So then I started to have to make my way back through the field of nettles, and then open my bag back in my room, and then go back into the hall. And then, you know, no one noticed I'd gone. It was horrible. I thought, well, you know, that was a huge drama, and everyone's just sitting as if nothing's happened. And for me, it's been like I've been through this sort of like amazing experience. And so I sat at the back, because I used to sit on the back, and about 10 cushions and piles of different kinds of adjustments, and sat in just in this heap again. Oh, here we are, another 5 days. So, but for some reason, I did have a mindful moment, and something happened, because within a few months, I was back again. And it was, I think, on the second retreat, or maybe third one I was doing, that Ajahn Chah came. And I'd never really seen anyone like Ajahn Chah. We were all sitting there, and suddenly this guy comes in. He's small and he's round. He's got a big belly, and he's got this robe on and shaved head. And next to him was his Western disciple, Ajahn Sumedho, who was really, really tall and really big. And so they looked really odd together. And to me, I thought they looked like they'd just come in from a spaceship, because they were clearly not from England. And they were clearly very different. And the vibe was really like, well, who are these? You know, I thought, I've got to go check these guys out. And the first thing that Ajahn Chah did is, we had this little Buddha statue that none of us quite knew. I didn't even know I was doing Buddhism, actually. We didn't quite know what it was. We just thought it was some artifact, so we just shoved it in the corner. It had cobwebs on it. And Ajahn Chah came in the room, and he looked at this Buddha, and he just went up and he bowed. But it was such a beautiful bow. It was like, for me, it felt like, well, that's a perfect gesture in relationship to life, you know, that you just sort of bow. And then that evening, I escaped the retreat yet again, because he was giving some teachings in Oxford. And he gave this Dharma talk. And I didn't understand. It was in Thai, and it was translated. But I kept thinking, there was something about his presence, and the quality of what I did understand, very little, that really struck me, and I remember sitting there thinking, you know, this is really an amazing experience. This is really good. His talk was really good. And then at the end of the talk, he said, well, if you've been sitting here thinking this is good or this is bad, you haven't been listening properly. And I thought, well, that's really good. So I was caught by Ajahn Chah. And then, I thought, well, I've got to somehow figure out how to hang around this guy. And it wasn't actually, as it turned out, it wasn't that long before he turned up. For some bizarre reason, he turned up at the community I was living in, where we were a community that were bringing over the Goenka retreats in the early days into England. And we were very keen, and we were trying to meditate, and we'd rented this together. We did all sorts of odd jobs, and we had this beautiful home that we had rented together, about 15 or so of us, in West Sussex, which is a very lovely county. And one day I was thinking a lot about Ajahn Chah and these monks, and I was also thinking about what should I do with my life, you know. And it was the one day I made a list of all the possibilities of things I could do, and it didn't look a very inspiring list. But at the bottom, I'd put at the bottom, well, maybe go check out Ajahn Chah a bit more. And then that day that I'd made this list, he actually turned up at the community. There was a knock at the door. I mean, it sounds a bit weird. I can't even believe it's true, but it is true. And he came in, and as it was, he was with another American monk whose parents had come to England, and he was showing this monk around. And this monk was showing his parents around. And they'd come to this village because it was one of these very picturesque chocolate box kind of typical English villages where we had this house. So Ajahn Chah came in to the room, and we all sat round the table with him. And I didn't know about etiquette, that you should bow and do all this stuff around monks. We just sort of sat round and looked at him. So And he looked at us, and he looked at each person, and he went round, and then he just said, in Thai, have you had enough yet? But the way he said it, it was like, you know, have you had enough? It wasn't like, you know, how are you doing? Are you okay? One thing about Ajahn Chah, he never had to please anyone. He wasn't making small talk. He just went straight to the right issue, you know, like, have you had enough of samsara? You know, has it hurt enough yet? So it was very penetrated very deeply. And then he, I don't know what else he said, but I was, you know, quite struck, by his presence, because he had this very, he was very empty in a way, but very alive. And had this, he called it stabbing the heart. That was his method, that he would really go to make sure you wouldn't forget the encounter. So then he went, and he went back to stay at this Burmese center where we used to go to meditate. And I rang up my friend, and I said, you know, you've got to come and meet this guy, this monk. You know, he's really a master. And so I dragged my friend up to Oxford again, and we found Ajahn Chah in this hut where he was staying. And I just went up and knocked on the door, like bam, bam, bam. And again, I wasn't very aware of etiquette, that it wasn't perhaps how you approach the whole thing. And he opened the door, and he looked pretty fierce. And I thought, uh-oh. Because before he was quite smiling and warm, powerful, but had this warmth to him. And he looked, and he invited my friend and myself in, and there was a few monks sitting there, and the Western monk who was translating. And he asked a few questions, and then he said, So do you understand anatta, which means not self? And me, having done a few meditation retreats and being an idiot, I said, oh yes. So he asked me to explain. So I was on the spot, and so I started to, I don't know what I was saying, but I knew I was in trouble, because the more I talked, the more my sense of self just grew and grew and grew, until I was like, just me, there's just a big me, and the more me in the room, the more empty and empty he became. And I had this feeling of like walking a plank, you know, like you just get to the edge and you're about to fall in the ocean, and I was just there like swaying, and I just, in the end, I just stopped because I knew that I was completely off the rails and caught. I was caught out. And then he leaned over and he said something in Thai, and the monk didn't want to translate it. So he said it again very pointedly, and so the monk, the American monk, leaned over and he said, well, he says you're very ignorant. And it's like he just kind of pricked my whole balloon. And then he gave this, you know, he was so empty himself, and then he talked about emptiness and non-self from a place of really being empty. So Ajahn Chah was someone that really turned my understanding of practice. I later went to Thailand, and I wasn't sure what to do really, actually, after meeting him, because I was on the sort of track of getting married. I had this boyfriend for about 4 years, and it was a little difficult to know what to do. And one day I got into quite a stress about what should I do? Should I get married? And should I go be a, I didn't think about being a nun, but should I go meditate more? And I remember getting on this train. I thought, oh, I'm going to go see Ajahn Chah again. At that point, he was in London. And I got on this train. I thought, no, I'd better go back to my boyfriend. So I got off the train and crossed the tracks and went back again. And then I thought, no, I'll go see Ajahn Chah. I got off the train, crossed the track, and got back again. And I was doing this. You know, talk about doubt. And then the ticket inspector got on the train. He said, where are you going? I said, I don't know. So he said, well, I think you just better go that way. So the ticket inspector decided. And so I ended up going up to London and being again, hanging out, and eventually went to Thailand. I didn't actually go to Thailand to see Ajahn Chah, but it happened that I landed up in Thailand and used the opportunity to go and practice and see him, and he sent me off to be a nun, and which I decided not to be, because it was, you know, I hadn't told my mum and dad, you know, so I thought I better go and tell my mum and dad and my boyfriend, and you know, and so I came back to England. And Ajahn Chah, he came twice to England. This is a long time ago, 1977 and 1979. So the second time when he came back, that's when I came back also to England and went to see him again. And he looked at me and said, well, why did you come back? Why aren't you a nun? And I was like going on about Western karma and being in the West, and Western, you know, I should be practicing here. And someone was translating for me, and that happened to be Kittisaro. Though I don't know if you remember that, when he was a monk, he was trying to translate. So, and then as it turned out, the first monastery in the West from that school started just down the road from the community I was staying in. And I got back to the community after this exchange with Ajahn Chah, and started to think about, oh, I better go back to Thailand. And then I said to one of my friends, could you drive me to this place? Because the monks are living there and I want to go check it out. And so my friend drove me, and I landed up staying there. That place happened to become Chithurst Monastery. And I ended up staying there for 12 years. I became a nun and didn't leave. And so, and around that time, Ajahn Chah then became very sick. And in 1981, a couple of years after I had took my first ordination, he had a kind of a stroke, and he had a manner of different things go wrong, and he landed up being unable to speak, and then pretty much semi-paralyzed, and then totally paralyzed for about 10 years. Which was a very intense thing that happened for the community, that he basically just wasn't accessible in the normal way anymore. And so suddenly we found ourselves in the West and part of this emerging new community with our Western teacher and trying to find a way to continue to practice. But one of the things that Ajahn Chah did transmit, and I think it's one of the things I'm very grateful for, among many things, is this establishment of what he would call right view, or what the Buddha called right view, being able to use everything in our lives for our practice. That everything that happens to us, it can be a part of what we can contemplate. At first, sometimes when we start to practice, we want to have a pleasing experience. And some people don't get past the first initial part of entering a meditation training because, you know, very quickly we start to notice that it's not so easy. Some people have, perhaps many of us, and I know I did, I had an idea that you just sit down and somehow magically go into bliss and peace. And certainly, you know, the spiritual marketplace really appeals to that level of our desire, you know, just to practice some kind of spiritual practices to become more peaceful or more powerful or more wealthy or more confident or more well in many ways. And all of these actually aren't bad motivations. They get us going, and it's not bad to actually improve ourselves in our life and to create and generate positivity. These are all can be quite wholesome. But inevitably in a spiritual life, we're going to come across the experience of suffering and difficulty and challenge, as many of you, all of you, have experienced during this retreat in different ways and yet have stayed with it. And so at a certain point we have to deepen our motivation to have the energy and the inspiration to go beyond just wanting a nice time in this practice. And so this Ajahn Chah really encouraged to not fear the experience of suffering or the things that come to challenge us, but to see them as opportunities. And while, as the Buddha taught, that the ignorance in the mind conditions suffering, suffering conditions the arising of the path. And so we can really feel resistant to the experience that we might have of difficulty and dukkha, and yet it's that very experience that brings about our interest in developing the path and cultivating the path. And so Ajahn Chah would really point to this all the time. You know, where is the suffering in the mind, and how is it being generated? And how are you creating it? That second arrow that Kitty Saro talked about on this retreat, the mental pain on top of the difficulty of what already is. And to really explore this and learn this, because this is a really wonderful and important thing for us to be able to understand in our lifetime. So that we don't just suffer heedlessly and unconsciously, that we can really overcome a lot of suffering that's just generated from our habits and our lack of understanding. And in this way, although the Buddha, you know, when you think about the Buddha and you hear about the Buddha, he sounds like some kind of superman. In a certain way he was, but in some ways the path he laid out and the practice he laid out was a path for human beings like us. It doesn't mean to say it wasn't challenging or difficult, but it's certainly doable. And in a certain way we could say that the Buddha isn't so much someone from the past, although he was historically a figure in the past, but he's someone of the future in terms of showing us what we can grow into, what we are growing into, both personally and collectively, that awakening isn't this great big thing that we aim for like some firework display, but it's a process that incrementally unfolds, the shifts that start to happen, and then if we're willing to walk the path and through the challenge of suffering, then it begins to mature into all aspects of our life, and we can start to work with all aspects of our life, our relationships. Certainly the Buddha, you know, the idea of the practitioner sitting removed from society was almost the Buddha's enlightenment. You know, after his enlightenment, he was incredibly engaged. You know, yes, there were moments of retreat, there were moments of gathering, there were moments of sitting under the tree, but there was this engagement in the world. With his family, he went back to his family, he went back to his community, he tried to stop wars, he tried to help people, tried to advise kings, tried to alleviate suffering. He was concerned with social justice and equality, and you know, so there was a very profound engagement in the culture and in the world. It wasn't an abdication of an ability to respond. And this came about because of the willingness to work with difficulty and to withstand the challenges of the world. And so the practice, while at a certain point makes us very sensitive, also in Ajahn Chah's warrior style, it would encourage us to have courage to meet our life and to meet the world and to be able to respond. And he was in many ways very fearless. I remember I wasn't actually there, but I heard the story how he would use every experience. That once when he was in London going on alms round, and as he was walking down the street, these young kids came up to him that were quite aggressive, and they started doing like karate chops towards him and like, you know, kicking their feet towards him. And in Thailand, the most rude thing you can do is to point your feet. And to point your feet or to kick your feet towards a great sage would be like sacrilege. So they were sort of like doing all this stuff and making fun of these monks. And the Western monks with him were like devastated. They were so embarrassed. And Ajahn Chah just kind of walked on, and then he got back to where they were staying at this house in London, and he turned to the monks and he laughed and he said, "Oh, I see you've got some really good teachers here." And then another time he came to the monastery, and after it had just started, the one that I went to, I just told you about, and he asked the abbot there, he said, "Well, how are you all getting on here?" And the abbot said, "No, we're doing well. We're really, really doing well." And then Ajahn Chah said, "Oh, well, there won't be much wisdom then, will there?" It's not that we should go out of our way to seek suffering, but when it comes, this is, as he would say, is the sharpening stone. Because to overcome the challenges that we have individually, in our families, collectively, it requires that we grow, we grow up, we mature, and that we deepen our motivation. And then, you know, not only for our own self, but ultimately as the practice matures, we can begin to also connect with this deeper, Skidisa was talking about last night, that as we let go, we're not letting go into a void. We're letting go into a deeper connection with all of life. Into a profound intimacy with all of life, actually. We're not separate from all of life. And in that way, there is the compassion, there is the resonance. And this kind of motivation, when we start to touch into that, has great power in it. It enables us to stretch beyond our limits in the same way as the analogy the Buddha gave of parents stretching beyond their limits for the sake of helping to offer what's needed for their child or children. In the same way, as we grow in the Dharma, the world in a way becomes like our child. It becomes something wherever we can touch and respond and help and alleviate the suffering not only in ourselves but in the world around us. This is what is modeled by the life of the Buddha, to not shy away from that, to not think the practice is just about retreating into our special space. So the path is a long journey, but it's always only ever here and now. It's always only ever this much. And that's, although sometimes it can feel challenging, actually what we're doing is really just being as present as we can in this moment. And as we're present and applying these factors of the path, moments of being here, attentiveness, then it will unfold organically and naturally, our awakening and the maturing of our awakening. And as we deepen more and more present and listen into the stillness and the silence of the heart, this is where we find our meeting place with each other, with all beings. I remember a very dear friend of mine. In fact, she was the person that was the attendant, my attendant when I went to India as a Buddhist nun, is that she had a child. She was in the monastery for a while, and then she left, and then she had a child. And this child died when it was about 18 months old. It had a brain tumor that wasn't diagnosed. And it was completely unexpected, of course, and there was nothing, because it was unexpected and the circumstances that unfolded, that it was unavoidable that she lost her child. And of course it was a tremendous devastation for her. And we used to spend a lot of time hanging out and being together around this whole process of the loss of her child. And one day because she was a practitioner, she said, you know, every time I think about my son, the son that died, I feel this tremendous anguish and sorrow. But when I listen into my heart, I know he is listening too, that he never went anywhere, that this is where he still is. And it's a really beautiful way of understanding the depth of our true connection, that when we enter this profound heart of stillness and listening and presence, it's there that we meet all beings, that we meet ourselves, that we meet this world, where we can hold this world and its suffering with compassion, with kindness, with patience, and with mercy. So these days we live in intense times, increasingly intense situation. May we dedicate our retreat tonight as we come to the closing night. All the blessings and good efforts we've made to our families for their well-being and our communities, and particularly to this land and this country and this area. And further afield, across this great continent and the oceans and all continents, all beings and the great earth herself. May we dedicate the blessings of our practice. May there be peace and freedom from suffering.